Well, you made it to the final unit. Hopefully you can make it through the final unit, which is three chapters big. The first of those final three chapters we start today, which is a chapter about meiosis and sexual life cycles. And so before we talk about sexual life cycles, we should compare the two kinds of reproduction found in biology, which is asexual reproduction and sexual reproduction. That's the purpose of this slide, just to give you an example of an organism of each type. The hydra on the left is an example of an organism that reproduces asexually. The redwoods, sexually. But that doesn't really tell you what the definitions of these two are. Asexual reproduction, which simply means not sexual, involves just one parent. A single parent produces offspring that are identical to the parent, genetically speaking. Now, prokaryotes are not only asexual, but they are unicellular, right? And when they reproduce, which is by binary fission, the parent no longer exists. The parent does not survive reproduction, right? The parent reproduces by splitting into two cells. So you have two offspring, no parent anymore. But they are genetically identical to each other because they're both genetically identical to the original cell. This hydra, on the other hand, is multicellular, and it reproduces by an asexual technique called budding, in which case basically a new body of the original organism sprouts out the side and then eventually detaches. But it's made up of genetically identical cells compared to the original parent. Sexual reproduction, on the other hand, involves two parents, each of which contribute some genetic material to the offspring. And so, because of that, the offspring produced in sexual reproduction are genetically distinct from each other, and they're also genetically distinct from both parents. Sexually produced offspring aren't like either parent, right? In fact, they are unlike any other organism. When sexual reproduction happens, it produces offspring that have a sequence of DNA that has never existed before, because it's a random combination of DNA from both of the two parents. Now, there's not one correct or better method here. Each of the two modes of reproduction has advantages and disadvantages. If you think about asexual reproduction, what are some advantages? There's a couple big advantages. That's right. It's just simpler, for one thing. You don't have to involve two parents. It's a simpler way of going about it, and therefore doesn't have complications that sex does. What about the fact that it produces, asexual reproduction produces genetically identical offspring, genetically identical to the parent? When would that be a good idea? Under what conditions would that actually be advantageous, to have offspring that are just like you?
Clones.
Well, yeah, they are in a sense clones, but when would that be the way to go? If you had a choice, when would you want to have offspring?
When you have really good, healthy genes.
Yes. But to say that a different way, if you are well adapted, if you have a high fitness, which is kind of a 182 thing that you learn more about. That means you are very well adapted to the environment in which you live. You do very well because of your particular genetic makeup that gives you your traits. And so it's the if it ain't broke, don't fix it adage, right? If you are very well adapted, why would you want to mix anything up? Make copies of yourself and your offspring will be adapted as well. But there's a potential problem with that. What does that assume? For your offspring, which are identical copies of you, to be well adapted assumes what? Yes, but real environments, of course, do change. And so if there's an abrupt change in the environment, then making an identical copy is going to produce something that isn't necessarily well fit, right? Sex, on the other hand, is a crapshoot. You don't know what you're going to get. And it's random, therefore you could easily produce offspring that aren't as fit as you. But since it is random, it's also possible that offspring will be even better fit to you, even in the face of a changing environment. And that's why it was so successful, and that's why there are so many sexual species. But there's plenty of examples of asexual species and sexual species, both. Those are the fundamental differences, though. All right, now to two, in which case we see this black background photograph. That photograph is an example of something we call a karyotype, which you'll notice has the same karyo root as eukaryotic and prokaryotic, which I told you, oh, those many weeks ago, means kernel. But specifically, that's referring to a nucleus, the kernel of a cell or the core of the cell, if it has one, right? Well, the reason they called this thing a karyotype, which is a picture of the chromosomes, is that in a eukaryotic cell, where you find the chromosomes, is the nucleus. This particular karyotype, by the way, is from a eukaryotic cell. And there's two major ways that I can tell this and that you should be able to tell this. What are the two ways? They are linear chromosomes, yes. And what else? Linear versus circular. So that's eukaryotic. 23. Also, there's more than one. A prokaryotic cell has one circular chromosome. This is several linear chromosomes. So this is not only eukaryotic. This particular example is a human cell. And it is a karyotype is a real photograph, a photomicrograph taken through with the help of a microscope. But obviously these chromosomes do not pose like this. They don't line up. What you take as the actual photograph is wherever they are, whatever position they are in the cell at the moment. But you don't just use any cell. You find a cell that is in metaphase. It says that somewhere. Why does that make sense? Why choose a cell that's in metaphase to take the picture? No, they are lined up in metaphase, that's true. That is part of the reason. Because when they're lined up, it's easier to tell them separately apart. But there's another reason that it's easy to tell them apart. Because in metaphase, that's when they are as condensed as they'll ever be. They're the smallest version, and therefore space between them. But just taking the picture doesn't end up being like this, sorted by size, as you see here. So this is a doctored picture. You have to cut and paste each chromosome to put them in this ordering. And cut and paste was literally the old-fashioned way, was to take a picture, print it with the chromosomes there, and then cut out the photographic paper and paste it onto another piece ordered like this. Now we can, of course, do it electronically. But they're not only ordered in size, starting with the largest, as you see, but each numbering here, 1, 2, 3, and so on, is really a pair of chromosomes. And the cartoon version of the first pair here is shown on the left. Not only is it a pair of chromosomes, but each individual chromosome in this pair is a replicated chromosome. So what looks kind of like an X here is two distinct chromosomes. Each chromosome individually would look like an X if you opened it up, because it's two sister chromatids held together at a centromere. Same with the other one. Okay? The reason these are paired together is because they are the same kind of chromosome, which is why they're the same size. And what you see here, since this is a human example, is that humans have 23 kinds of chromosomes. Now, why is it that you would have two number ones, two number twos, and so on? No. That's why you have replicated chromosomes.
From the parents?
Yes. The answer is because humans are sexual species. So one of those two number ones came from the father, one of the other number one came from the mother, and same thing for 2 through 23. In an asexual species, you wouldn't have two of each kind of chromosome. All right, so that's why there are two. The fact that these two that are the same size correspond to each other is expressed by the word homologous. This is a homologous pair. When you count both of these two number ones, that's one homologous pair. Homologous means that they correspond to each other. Now, that means they have the same kinds of genes. It's not necessarily the same versions of genes, as we'll talk more about in the next chapter. But the genes that are on the number two chromosomes are all about a totally different set of proteins. Okay, so that's what makes different kinds of chromosomes different. The only other thing I want to say about this one is that notice in the numbering that it only goes up to 22, and then there's this XY pair. There's 23 kinds of chromosomes, but these ones that are numbered 1 through 22 are examples of what we call autosomes. Auto meaning self, some like in chromosome meaning body. So autosomes are chromosomes, but then this final pair, the number 23 pair, are examples of sex chromosomes. And the autosomes get their name, including that self root, because their genes are indirect codes for how to build proteins that are important for making up you for your lifetime, yourself. That's true for some of the genes on the sex chromosomes as well, but the reason they are called sex chromosomes is because they also have the function of determining the sex of any offspring you might make. And for instance, this individual from the karyotype corresponding to this individual has an X and a Y and therefore is a male. An XX would be a female. More about that later, though. Before I leave this, though, I just used the phrase homologous pair, which is one way you can call this pair of two number ones or two number twos or so on. You can say homologous pair, that's perfectly fine. Another word, though, for a homologous pair is a tetrad. or at least we can use the word tetrad when the two come together, when they find each other, which we'll talk about later. Tetrad is just a general word that means four-part thing, right? Tetra means four. The reason that makes sense is that these two chromosomes are each replicated chromosomes, consisting of two sister chromatids. So there's really, when you group both the chromosomes together, you have four chromatids, a tetrad. Okay, let's go on to three. Now it's time to give you some more definitions that are really important to fully grasp. So if you don't understand these, don't let me continue until you do understand these, because there's two definitions I'm going to give you that are confusing to a lot of students at first, because they both have to do with numbers of chromosomes, but in totally different ways. One term is really a symbol, which is N, which is intentionally a variable. But N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes that that species has. That's why it's a variable, because each species has a different value of N. And as I just said, humans have 23 kinds of chromosomes, right? So their N is 23. And that's pretty straightforward to understand. But that is totally different from ploidy. Ploidy is not the number of different kinds of chromosomes. I just told you that's N. Ploidy is how many of each kind of chromosome there are in a cell. If you think back to the human karyotype we just looked at, the N was 23, because there's 23 different kinds, right? But in that case, the cell that those chromosomes came from contained two of each kind, right? So the ploidy is not about 23. The ploidy is about the fact that there are two of each kind. There's different degrees of ploidy, in other words. Ploidy is just the general word. But the most frequently occurring degrees of ploidy are that are the possibilities of having just one of each kind or of having two of each kind. If a cell has exactly one of each kind of chromosome, however many there are, and it'll be N for that species, then that is a haploid cell. All right? And so for any given species, if you have a haploid cell, how many total chromosomes are in that cell? Haploid is the condition of having one of each kind of chromosome for the species in that cell. No. Not necessarily. I said for any given species, if you have a haploid cell, how many total chromosomes are in that cell?
One.
Not necessarily. Well, I told you it's a haploid cell, right? That, by definition, means you have one of each kind of chromosome.
So 23?
Not necessarily.
It
does depend. Therefore, the answer is what?
Infinite.
No.
Oh, a variable?
Is N? N. Yes. N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes that that species has, right? So if you have a haploid cell, the total number of chromosomes is therefore N, because there's just one of each. And that's why N itself is often called the haploid number. And similarly, 2N is called the diploid number. That's the other major possibility for ploidy. A diploid cell, with di meaning two, is a cell that contains two of every kind of chromosome that that species has. Right? So that's what that karyotype of the human was in the previous slide. How many total chromosomes were there?
23?
No.
46.
46, which is 2N for humans. Right? N for humans is 23. A diploid cell has 2N total chromosomes. Because it has two number ones, two number twos, two number threes. That's the two of diploid. Two of each kind. So diploidy has nothing to do with how many kinds there are. Diploid means that there are two of each kind. And that's because there's one from each of the two parents.
So
two times, or 2N. 2N is the general number of total chromosomes in a diploid cell. It just depends on what N is, which depends on the species. All right, so in this fictitious species that a cartoon cell is drawn for here, right here, how many kinds of chromosomes are there?
Three.
Yes, three. Why do you say three? Okay, but if we didn't have that shown there, how would you know there are three chromosomes? And just from the picture alone. Different sizes, yes. Has nothing to do with color. Think back to the karyotype. The two number ones were the biggest ones. They were equal size. Same size as each other, right? But a different size from number two and three and so on. So you have three different kinds of chromosomes here. Large, medium, and small. That's why N equals 3, because there are three kinds. What is the ploidy of this cell?
2N?
Yes, but instead of saying 2N, which is the number of total chromosomes, when I ask what the ploidy is, you use the word diploid. It is a diploid cell. Because there are three kinds of chromosomes, but, and that three kinds has nothing to do with ploidy, it's diploid because there are two of each of those three kinds. And the coloring here denotes parental origin of those chromosomes. So notice that one big one is blue, one big one is red. One medium one's red, one medium one's blue. The blue ones came from the mother, from the father, the red ones came from the mother. Okay? What else can you say about every one of these chromosomes? Chromosomes themselves aren't sexual, no. The species is. Just look at any individual chromosome there, and besides it calling it a chromosome, what else can you tell me about it? Not that word doesn't make any sense if you're looking at only one chromosome. I'm just saying, look at this, just this one. If I tell you that's a chromosome, if you don't already know that, what else can you tell me about it? By the way it looks. Yes, because it's linear, but that's not what I'm trying to get at. It's replicated. Yes, it's made up of two sister chromatids that are identical to each other. Right? So a chromosome can be replicated or unreplicated. This one is replicated. Okay, everyone good with all these definitions so far? Because it's really important to understanding the stuff coming up. Let's go to 4 and use humans as an example to investigate sexual life cycles. So this circular arrangement is a sexual life cycle. Now that has nothing to do with the lifetime of an individual. A sexual life cycle is the time between generations in a sexual species. So from one generation to the next. And even though we're looking at humans here as an example, just to make it familiar with us, what I'm about to say is actually true for any sexual species. Any sexual species features a generation to generation alternation between two important processes. So it goes back and forth between these two processes from generation to generation. And those two processes are shown in the boxes here. Fertilization and meiosis. Not just for humans, not just for animals that we're examples of, for all sexual species. Okay, it's going to go fertilization, meiosis, over and over each generation. So since that's true, we better get good definitions of these two processes. Starting with fertilization. Fertilization is the defining event of sex. Really the only reason we call a species sexual is that fertilization happens. There's all other kinds of things involved with sex. Like mating, for instance, not necessary. Plants don't mate. They're sexual species because they can undergo fertilization. It's fertilization that makes it sex. That's what I mean by it's the defining event. But what it is, fertilization, is the fusion of two unicellular gametes. To produce one unicellular zygote. Gamete is the unisex term for sex cell. So there are male gametes, there are female gametes. For humans, the male gametes are sperm. For female, the gametes are eggs. And those words are used for a lot of different species, but not all. In any case, any sexual species features male gametes and female gametes. All right, now each individual gamete is a single cell. In fertilization, the male gamete and the female gamete fuse into one cell called the zygote, which is the official beginning of the next generation. That was the official beginning of your life when you were one cell produced when your father's sperm fused with your mother's egg. And notice that this is a bit of an exception to cell theory, right? What does cell theory tell us? Exactly. And cells come from pre-existing cells usually by a cell splitting into two cells, right? Here we have the opposite. Two cells fusing into one, which is still a new cell. That zygote is a cell that hasn't existed before. But it still relies on pre-existing cells. Okay, now, each gamete before the fertilization event is carrying chromosomes of its own. And when the fertilization happens, that fusion of the two gametes to produce the zygote means that the zygote that results is going to contain chromosomes from each of the two gametes. In other words, using our definitions, fertilization doubles the ploidy. Right? Because now you have a zygote with twice as many chromosomes as each of the individual gametes had. Is that clear? Well, you have to have that doubling of ploidy if you're going to have fertilization. And you have to have fertilization if you want to randomize the genetic sequence, basically. That's what sex is all about. But that ploidy, that doubling of the ploidy, is a problem also. Because if that's the only thing that were happening each generation, then that means every generation would have twice as much DNA as the previous generation. First it would be diploid, and then the next generation tetraploid, and then octuploid, right? And then you'd have 16 times as much DNA. Well, it wouldn't last. The species would go extinct because there would be no possibility that cells could contain that much DNA. We've already talked about how amazing it already is that as much DNA as is contained in a cell can be contained, not only in an invisibly tiny cell, but in an even smaller nucleus within that cell. So if you keep doubling it, it's going to become impossible very soon, within a couple generations. Therefore, in order to have this doubling, which is highly advantageous because of the mix-up in DNA that results with sex, then you also have to have a mechanism that undoes the doubling. In other words, a mechanism that cuts the ploidy in half to undo that doubling. And that's what meiosis is. Meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. So from generation to generation, you have a doubling, and then half back to normal, halving back to normal, and then a doubling, and then halving back to normal, so that it doesn't build up from one generation to the next. It stays constant overall. In other words, it goes back and forth between 2N and N. 2N and N. And you can see that in symbols here. This is not true for more than just humans. Any sexual species has a sexual life cycle that features a haploid part of the cycle and a diploid part of the cycle. Okay, that's just the human example, but in slide 5 we can look at more than just us. This isn't every single sexual species represented here, but there's three major groups here. Animals, which we're included in, of course. Plants in the middle, and most fungi represented on the right. But notice that in every one of these, just like all the ones that aren't shown here, the life cycle features a haploid part and a diploid part. And it also features an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. Well, for animals, the diploid part of the sexual life cycle dominates the life cycle. Most of the time is spent in the diploid stage. Not only that, but for animals, only the diploid stage is multicellular. The haploid stage is unicellular. Okay, so fertilization, like any fertilization, is going to fuse two unicellular gametes into one unicellular zygote, right? By definition. That's what this 2N circle is. That's one cell. That's how you started. But that one cell that you started out didn't last as one cell very long. Shortly thereafter, it underwent mitosis, which produced two identical diploid cells, which underwent mitosis to become 4 and then 8 and so on. That's how we become multicellular. Mitosis, right? And we live our lives as multicellular diploid organisms, we animals. When we produce gametes, we do that via meiosis, which I've already told you reduces the ploidy in half. So that's going to produce gametes that are haploid, which of course is appropriate, right? Because if gametes of the two types get together, the two haploids will make a diploid zygote. You know, most humans don't think of it, of gametes as being separate organisms, but they are. Each sperm and each egg is really just a unicellular human. And they don't live very long for either of two reasons. One is that they just don't live long if they don't engage in fertilization. They'll just die pretty soon. Like the vast majority of sperm that have ever been created just get wasted. Or they just die, I mean. Not the same is true for eggs, for that matter. Or they don't last very long because if they do engage in fertilization, a sperm and an egg come together, then they no longer exist as sperm and egg, right? Now they are zygote, which is a totally different cell, which is a totally different organism. That's a diploid human. And that's going to grow up through mitosis into a multicellular diploid animal. All right? That's how we live our sexual life cycles. Let's go to the other extreme first before going to the middle, which is most fungi. I go there first because they, in a sense, are the inverse of our life cycle. Their sexual life cycle is dominated by the haploid generation. And only the haploid generation for fungi is multicellular. The diploid generation in fungi is unicellular. What this means is that an adult multicellular fungus that you see has a body made out of haploid cells, unlike our diploid cell bodies. Okay? That's what I mean by it's being dominated by the haploid stage. Fertilization happens the same way. It's, once again, fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce a diploid zygote for a fungus. But unlike us, this fungus zygote does not undergo mitosis to become multicellular. Instead, it immediately, as one cell, undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells, which then individually undergo mitosis to become multicellular haploid fungi. Does that all make sense? When it comes time for an adult fungus to make its gametes, it does not use meiosis because it's already haploid, right? Doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis. You're already at one copy each. You can't reduce it in half. So since they're already haploid, to make haploid gametes, they simply use mitosis, which doesn't change the ploidy. All right? That's kind of the inverse of us. But notice that for both animals and fungi, only one of the two generations is multicellular. For animals, it's the diploid stage. For fungi, it's the haploid stage. Plants are shown in the middle because they are multicellular in both generations. This is a special condition that is called alternation of generations. Plants have an alternation of generations, which is, I don't want you to confuse that word, since it includes alternation word, I don't want you to confuse that phrase with what I told you before. That has nothing to do with alternating between meiosis and fertilization. That's true for all sexual species, not just plants. What we call alternation of generations in plants really should be more specifically called alternation of multicellular generations, because the diploid stage and the haploid stage are both multicellular, unlike us and unlike fungi. What that means is that for the same species of plant, there are two versions, multicellular, that look different. But one of them is made up of haploid cells and the other one's made up of diploid cells. The haploid generation, by the way, is called the gametophyte generation. This phyte word means plant, and so gametophyte means the gamete-producing plants. They produce gametes by mitosis just like fungi do because they're already haploid. The diploid generation is called the sporophyte generation, the spore-producing plants, which produce spores by haploid spores by meiosis, just like we produce our gametes, because they're diploid. Okay, let's go on and discuss meiosis itself, starting with six. Meiosis confuses the hell out of a lot of students, at first at least. So make sure you don't let me go on if you don't understand any of this stuff I go through. I'm going to continuously compare mitosis and meiosis. So one key to understanding meiosis is not, other than knowing these terms that I've already gone through, is having a good grasp on mitosis, which is pretty easy to understand. We've already covered. Okay, so I hope you have remembered the details of mitosis, even though you've been tested on it already. I'll get to those comparisons in a second, but here we have a fictitious species, a cell from some made-up species at the top here. How many kinds of chromosomes are there in this top cell?
One.
Therefore, what is the N? One. N is how many kinds of chromosomes there are. So it's the same question, different phrased. Yes, there's one. Just one size, right? And what's the ploidy?
Haploid.
No. Haploid means there's one of each kind. There's one kind here, right? That's why the N is one. But there are two of each kind. So there are two N total cells, chromosomes here, right? This is a diploid cell. They're the same size, though, so they're the same kind of chromosomes. You clear on this?
So if it was haploid, would there just be, like, for example, just one red and no blue?
Yes, just like these ones down here on the bottom. They are haploid.
Okay.
We'll get to that, but yes, this is how they would look. So, yes, it's N is one. It's a diploid cell. What can we say about the chromosomes?
In the first picture?
Yes, in the top one.
They're not
replicated. They are. Oh, yes, they aren't replicated. They're unreplicated. Now, that's why this is a lie, really, because you wouldn't see them as condensed chromosomes if they weren't already replicated, right? They're just trying to simplify what's going on and how much DNA is there by making them look like chromosomes. They wouldn't be, though, right? They would be loose chromatin, really. All the DNA is there. It just wouldn't appear condensed as a chromosome. So where is this top cell in the cell cycle?
Interphase.
Yes, specifically.
G1.
No, S is when it replicates.
G1.
Right. And that's why you wouldn't see a chromosome. It would just be loose chromatin being used for transcription. Okay? Now this cell is going to enter a different kind of M phase in the cell cycle. Not the mitotic phase, but the meiotic phase. It's going to undergo meiosis instead of mitosis, in other words. And I have to pause here because only certain kind of cells do this. So I'm going to distinguish two kinds of cells in your body, for example, but also not just your body. There are what are called somatic cells, which is kind of a misnomer because somatic means of the body. Well, both of your kinds of cells are part of your body. But the vast, vast majority of your body is made up of somatic cells. Almost every one of your 100 trillion cells is a somatic cell. There is a different kind of cell in your body, though, and those are called germline cells. They are found only in gonads. Gonad, like gamete, is a unisex term. Gametes are sex cells. Gonads are the organs that produce sex cells. So the gonads are the primary sex organs. In males, the primary sex organ are the testes. In females, the primary sex organs, or the gonads, are the ovaries. And not even those whole organs are made up of germline cells. Just a little bit of the organ is made up of germline cells, but that's the only place in your body where these germline cells are. Small population compared to your somatic cells. There's a distinction, of course, that I'm getting to, but the distinction between these two types of cells is not the ploidy. Somatic cells are diploid for you, for animals in general. Germline cells are also diploid. So it's not the ploidy that makes the distinction between these two categories. Instead, the distinction is what kind of cell division these two cells can undergo. For any given somatic cell, if it divides at all, which depends on the kind of cell it is, right? But if it's going to divide, it can do so only by mitosis. And mitosis does not change the ploidy. So since somatic cells are diploid in your body to start with, when they undergo mitosis, if they do, they'll just produce more diploid cells, genetically identical to themselves. A germline cell, on the other hand, has the job of producing gametes. That's what it's all about, which are haploid cells. But germline cells can undergo, or do undergo, both mitosis and meiosis. When you think about their goal, though, or their purpose, which is to produce gametes, which requires meiosis to reduce the ploidy in half, why would you bother also having mitosis, which happens first, by the way? It's mitosis first, then meiosis. But if you skipped that mitosis, you would still reduce the ploidy. You could still make gametes that are haploid using just meiosis. So why bother having this mitosis step first? Not the gametes. They're not gametes. Germline cells are not gametes. They are diploid. They can produce gametes if they undergo meiosis. But first, they undergo mitosis.
Replicate the chromosomes?
Replication is correct, because that's what happens with mitosis, right? But this has to do with what I told you about the scarcity of them in your body. A tiny population of your body cells are the germline cells. If they only went into meiosis, every time that happened, the population would get smaller, right? Because the cell that goes into meiosis is no longer there. It becomes gametes, right? So you would run out. Instead, what happens is that a cell in this tiny population of germline cells first undergoes mitosis. It no longer exists. But now two copies of itself do exist, one of which will stay behind to replace the one that was lost, and the other one will then go on to meiosis to produce gametes, and you maintain that small population. Okay, now let's go back to this picture. So this top figure we said was G1, even though it would be chromatin and rather than chromosomes. Unreplicated, though. Then it goes through S, which is when it becomes replicated. It would still be chromatin, but the second cell shown below it is even later than that. This is now in meiosis. So you can see distinct chromosomes, and they are replicated chromosomes, right? So the top one had an N of 1. What is the N of this second cell?
Two.
One, N doesn't change. N is the species number of chromosomes, right? Number of types. Diploidy was diploid up here. What is diploidy of this second one? In words.
Diploid.
It's also diploid, right? The only difference is that this is a diploid cell featuring unreplicated chromosomes. This is a diploid cell featuring replicated chromosomes. N is one in both cases. Everyone good with all that? Okay, now to meiosis itself. I've already told you one major difference, kind of the difference between meiosis and mitosis. That's the reduction in ploidy. Another difference is that whereas mitosis involves one division event and therefore produces two cells for the cell that enters mitosis, meiosis involves two division events. And we call the two halves of overall meiosis, therefore, meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 with Roman numerals. Meiosis 1 features the first splitting, so that original cell becomes two cells, and then each of those two cells enter meiosis 2 to split again, so that you end up, after overall meiosis, with four cells. Now here's probably the hardest part of understanding meiosis, what I'm about to talk about. And this has to do with understanding what lines up and what splits. And I'm talking about meiosis 1 first, okay? Because meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 are obviously different. But let's compare mitosis to meiosis 1. I didn't mention it yet, but each of these subdivisions of meiosis, 1 and 2, are further subdivided into stages that have the same names as for mitosis, so prophase and so on. But in meiosis, there's going to be a prophase 1 and a prophase 2 later on in meiosis 2 and so on. Okay? Before we get into what happens in meiosis, though, let's quickly review mitosis. Specifically, when things line up, which is when in mitosis. Metaphase. It's critical for you to understand what it is that lines up in metaphase of mitosis. So tell me what that is. What is it that lines up? And we're going to assume that this is a diploid cell, okay, that's entering mitosis, which is not what we're looking at. Here, this is meiosis. Well, just imagine mitosis. For a diploid cell, what is it that specifically that lines up at metaphase? That's not specific enough. No. I mean, they are in the lineup, but they're connected to each other still. So they don't separately line up. What did you say? Well, it's all made out of DNA, so that could be the answer for that. These are two generals, what I'm saying. A pair of sister chromatids is the answer, but we call that one replicated chromosome, right? So what lines up during mitosis metaphase is individual replicated chromosomes. Okay? What I mean by individual replicated chromosomes is that they are not paired with their homologs. A homologous pair is made up of two homologs. Each replicated chromosome of the same type is called a homolog. And when you have the two number ones, that's a homologous pair. Okay? But for mitosis, the two homologs do not care where the other one is. The one number one, which is a replicated chromosome, lines up. And the other number one, which is a replicated chromosome, is going to be somewhere else lined up. That's what I mean by individual replicated chromosomes. So, since we're talking about a diploid cell here, how many things individually line up in metaphase of mitosis. For any given species, how many things would be lined up? Two N. Perfect. Yes. Two N different things. Whatever N is, it's double that, right? Because it's a diploid cell, and the two number ones are not together. The two number twos are not together. They're individually lined up. Okay. Then comes anaphase, right? Which is when the splitting occurs. In mitosis, what splits apart in anaphase? Well, what? Let me put it a different way. What separate from each other in anaphase? The halves of the replicated chromosomes, which we call what?
Sister chromatids,
yes. At least they're called sister chromatids up to the moment at which they actually split, right? When they do split, they're now called unreplicated chromosomes individually. Okay, so let's think about this in terms of humans. What is N? 23. So how many things are lined up for a diploid human cell at metaphase of mitosis?
46.
46, exactly. Each of which consists of two sister chromatids. When anaphase comes along, 46 unreplicated chromosomes are going to go to one cell. 46 unreplicated chromosomes are going to go to the other cell, right? Notice that you started with 46, 2N, it's a diploid cell. You end up with two cells, each with 46. The ploidy did not change. You just went from replicated to unreplicated. Is that clear? Mitosis does not change the ploidy.
Well, if you start with 46...
46 replicated chromosomes. And you end up with two cells, each with 46 unreplicated chromosomes. Just one of the two former sister chromatids. Okay, now let's go to meiosis with that knowledge in mind and compare it. In metaphase of meiosis 1, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. Instead, it's tetrads. In other words, it's pairs of homologous chromosomes. And the two number ones are together. They do care where each other are, or is. The two number twos are together, and so on. So this is a diploid cell entering meiosis one. How many things line up for any given species?
2N.
No. I just said that what lines up are pairs of chromosomes, homologous pairs. How many pairs do you have in a diploid cell? N.
Oh, man.
Right? There's a pair for each kind of chromosome. There are N kinds by definition. That's what N means. So there are two number ones, two number twos. Each pair is a tetrad. There's a tetrad number one, tetrad number two, all the way through 23 if it's humans, which is N, right? So instead of 2N individual replicated chromosomes lining up like they did in metaphase of mitosis, you have N homologous pairs of chromosomes lining up in metaphase of meiosis 1. Now this book, unfortunately, uses an N of 1 because it's the simplest case, but it's actually too simple and is confusing. So let me draw it for an N of 2. I think I'm going to have to get close to you guys momentarily. An N of 2, I'm going to draw both mitosis and meiosis. Okay, there's an N of 2, that means there's two types of chromosomes, right? But it's a diploid cell. So there's a big and a small, that's the two types. Each one of them is replicated, though, and there's two of each because it's a diploid cell. So for mitosis, metaphase, you would have one of the replicated big ones, another one of the replicated big ones, a replicated small one, and a replicated small one of the... all lining up individually, right? That's two N things because N is 2. And then what splits in anaphase are the sister chromatids. So the resulting cells are going to have too big and too small still. The ploidy does not change. It's just that they are now going to be unreplicated chromosomes. And the same thing for the other one, right? That's mitosis. If it's a 2N cell entering meiosis 1, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. It's pairs of homologous replicated chromosomes. The two big ones together is one tetrad. The two small ones together is the other tetrad. It's N things lining up here. You see that? And this is the metaphase plate. So what then splits in anaphase 1 is not sister chromatids from each other. It's homologs from each other. And so this cell is going to have still a replicated big and a replicated small. And the other one's going to have a replicated big, the other replicated big, and the other replicated small. Now, those are then going to undergo meiosis 2, which is going to be just like mitosis. It's going to split the chromatids apart. And so now they'll have one unreplicated big, one unreplicated small, same thing for the other two. Does that make it better than this?
Yes.
Okay, good. Really important point here is that in terms of goals for meiosis, the goal is to reduce the ploidy, right? That's why it's a necessary process, to achieve the halving of the ploidy. Well, notice that that occurs in meiosis 1, not meiosis 2. Do you recognize this original cell as diploid? Why is this diploid? No, two kinds is why it's N is 2. Ploidy has nothing to do with the kinds, or how many kinds there are. I mean, ploidy is how many of each kind there are.
Yeah. Well, because there's two of each.
There's kind. Two of each kind. That's why it's diploid. Mm-hmm. If I had done a 3N, there would be two of each of the three types. So 2 is a kind of confusing too, because then you mix it up that way.
Yeah.
3 is probably the best. But anyway, yes, this is a diploid cell, right? There's two bigs and two smalls, the two kinds. Okay, but when this splits, the homolog of this pair goes to one cell, the other homolog goes to the other cell. So each of these cells now is already haploid. Why is this haploid? Right. It has one of each type of cell. It has one of each of the two. N is 2, has one of each of those two types. One big, one small. Same with the other cell. So the reduction in ploidy has already happened, which is the goal of the overall process, meiosis, to reduce that ploidy. Why does it therefore have bother to go through another round, meiosis 2?
Separate the big and small.
No. That's not what happened. The reason it has to go through another round is because these two that result from meiosis 1 still have replicated chromosomes. They still have twice as much DNA as one cell should have, because each chromosome is two sister chromatids still. That's why you have to have a meiosis II that's just like mitosis to line those up and split the chromatids, not the homologs. There are no homologs anymore. Or the homologs are in separate cells at this point. Now you split the chromatids, and each of the resulting cells is still haploid, because just like mitosis, meiosis II does not change ploidy. They were already haploid after meiosis I. They stay haploid, but now they're unreplicated. Anything from that unclear still? Yeah, I don't expect you to be a master of it yet, but it's. Ask me now if any of that was not unclear or was unclear, because it won't get easier if you don't. Okay, well, let me see what time it is. Oh, still got 10 minutes. Let's go to 7 then, to look at the particulars of each subphase. This picture in 7 looks very similar to one that we looked at for mitosis before, except that there's two division events here, not just one. So we're looking at overall meiosis, which is meiosis 1 first and then meiosis 2. Now, I told you before that both meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 have subphases that have the same names as the mitosis subphases. So prophase 1, metaphase 1, and so on. But obviously there's different things happening in meiosis compared to mitosis, and there's also different things happening in meiosis 1 versus meiosis 2. Some of that we've already covered. But I want to talk, before we look at even more detail here, I want to talk more about what sex accomplishes being a sexual species. We've already said a little bit about this, that sex results in brand new genetic sequences, right, that have never existed before, because it involves two parents. Well, the only reason that that is true is because the parents are already genetically different from each other. If you think about this in comparison to cards, it's often said that sex shuffles the deck, making these random combinations for the offspring. But that only matters, shuffling a deck matters only if you have different kinds of cards, right? If you have a deck that is nothing but three of hearts, you can shuffle it as many times as you want, and everyone's going to get a hand of nothing but three of hearts. So sex does not create genetic diversity. It amplifies genetic diversity, but it relies on there already being genetic diversity, which it then scrambles. What is the original source of the genetic diversity that sex works on? Why is there genetic diversity to begin with, even before sex evolved?
Mutation,
exactly. Mutation is the original source of all genetic variation. Just the accidents that happen for various reasons is why there are different DNA sequences. This is the reason why we are not simply genetically identical copies of the original successful cell that is our ancestor. It's why there are different species and different individuals within species. Mutation brings the diversity originally. But once you have that, it's like now having a deck of different cards, and when you can shuffle, you can amplify that randomness, all right? And sex does this three different ways, all of which combine into many, many combinations. The first two occur before fertilization, which is what defines sex. Specifically, these first two, and I haven't given you the three yet, but the first two of the three occur in meiosis. and even in meiosis one. So let me give you these three. The three mechanisms that sex uses to amplify genetic variation are crossing over, independent assortment, and random fertilization. Obviously, random fertilization occurs during fertilization, right? I'll get to that eventually. But these other two happen. This is the order in which the three happen. And I said those both occur in meiosis one. Well, let's look at the details of meiosis one, or at least start looking at these before I run out of time. This is prophase one, which means prophase of meiosis one. And this is different from what happens in mitosis, if you think back. Remember, in mitosis, we didn't care about homologous pairs. The one number one didn't care where the other number one was. They were all acting independently. But in meiosis one, the two homologs, the two versions of the same type of chromosome, find each other and come together. And that coming together of homologous chromosomes is called synapsis. Syn means together. Not only do they come together, well, this synapsis, which is the coming together of the two homologs, of the two number ones, for instance, that results in a tetrad. We don't really use the word tetrad until the two homologs synapse. Okay, because now they are kind of acting as a unit. They're moving in the same direction, moving together. Not only do they synapse, though, to form the tetrad, but they cross over. That's what this first source of additional genetic variation is. Crossing over happens when, well, let's consider what we have here. A tetrad consists of two homologs, right? They're both the same kind of chromosome, but one came from the mother, one came from the father. They're homologous, but they're not identical DNA sequences, right? Because they're two different individuals they came from. There's two sister chromatids in one of the homologs are identical. The two sister chromatids in the other homolog are identical to each other. But there are non-sister chromatids, right, in the tetrad, one red one and one blue one, that cross over, physically cross that sequence. And that point at which they cross over is called a chiasma or chiasm, which means cross. Not only do they cross over, but when they form that chiasm or chiasma, same word really, they swap part of themselves with the corresponding part from the other non-sister chromatid. And so what was a totally red chromatid is now mostly red and the rest of it's blue because it swapped that part after the crossover point with the blue one. And the one that was formerly all blue is now mostly blue and some red. So notice that just for crossing over itself, just by itself, there already is a new version of DNA that's never existed. Because it already combines some of the DNA from each of the two parents. And consider that these are enormously long polymers. Each chromosome is a double helical DNA that is millions of nucleotides long, right? Which means there is one hell of a lot of possible positions at which it can cross over. And when you do the math on how many combinations that can lead to, just for two parents, I mean just for one cell, I'm sorry, one parent, because this is happening in meiosis before the gametes are produced. That is practically an infinite number. It's not truly infinite, of course, but it is so big that that crossing over alone is enough reason why, even if you lived millions of years and reproduced every year, you would still never make two identical offspring. The number is enormous. All right? Let me see what time it is. Do I have to stop? Yes, I do. So I'll talk about the other two later and the rest of meiosis later.